So this is a not a paper, this is a talk. It's a pretty informal talk. I first became aware of this. I originally gave it a wrong title when I first gave this talk in Obu a few months ago. I called it a case of degenerate action. And then I realized that that's not what I wanted to say. A degenerate action would be a sexually perverted action. And I certainly don't want to say that here. But anyway, degenerate case of action. So I don't know if those of you who know, there's a series that runs in the New York Times called The Stone. And I think I'm not sure if it's Simon Critchley or Gary Gutting, who's a philosopher at Notre Dame University, who sort of oversees it, or, you know,
it's
Gutting. He's the most frequent contributor, and then he allows other people to have debates and stuff like that. There was an article in his column. I became aware of not this original paper, but a paper. So this is from Nature Neuroscience, as you can see, from 2008. But there was a paper in Nature in 2011. So the Nature. You will see that in a second, that he was discussing this whole issue of free will and these experiments that I'm going to talk about today. So there'll be some mentioning of this and some of the things from... And so I trace from Gutting to the Nature paper, which was sort of also a review of this paper, and then I read this paper. So those are kind of the three things that are the basis of this. So I'm just going to go through some quotes and try to explain roughly what was going on here. It's, I guess, kind of fortunate that it was, a couple of weeks ago, Ryder presented the paper from Armstrong on Libet. And so that's maybe will save us a little time, although there's some differences here that are perhaps worth pointing out. I will do my best to make it apparent where the argument comes in. So if you're wondering where's the arguments, where are the arguments, I'll let you know where my complaints are as best I can. Okay. So unconscious determinants of free decisions in the human brain. This is in their paper. This is not the review article of their, this is their. The impression that we are able to freely choose between different possible courses of action is fundamental to our mental life. However, it has been suggested that this subjective experience of freedom is no more than an illusion, and that our actions are initiated by unconscious mental processes long before we become aware of our intention to act. So we have a couple of things going on here that are perhaps worth pointing out. First of all, they're referring to Libet's, that it has been suggested. So those experiments, which were done in the late 1989-90 at the University of California, San Francisco, I was actually working in the floor under him at the time, you know. It may be that I'll get to that aspect in a second, the media aspect of all this. Anyway, so one is that clearly these researchers seem to not be interested and seem to be interpreting Libet as addressing the question of free will, not the question of causation. Does the will, conscious will, cause our actions? So they seem to be interpreting them that way. Okay. That's one thing I wanted to point out. So they're interpreting it, and I think there's a direct reference to Libet here. So that's the only thing I wanted to say there. Here, okay, now, so why, what, I'll just mention what's going on here. First of all, they discuss, if you recall, the Libet experiment is, which we have the apparatus is on the skull measuring this readiness potential using technology that at the time was already kind of old. The idea would be that the person is told that they're going to push a button when they have the urge, when they decide to, and I guess they're kind of looking at something like this clock and remembering when they became aware of their conscious intention to push the button, and then they were able to take enough pictures and do enough sort of working up of the pictures that the claim, this isn't Libet I'm talking about, was that they could sort of see in this part of the brain where this readiness or action potential is happening, that before the person became conscious, in fact, a signal already started getting sent down the arm muscle, and then, well, we heard about that a couple of weeks ago. Some of the criticism, and they briefly discuss this in their paper, that was directed at Libet, and this came up to some extent with one of Soren's points, is that, you know, this measuring of when you became, when did you become aware of your conscious intention? A deep-seated skepticism about these experiments would sort of be suspicious about this, no matter how refined you made the experiments, just because there's simply, to some people's minds, something very fishy about science asking, as part of an experimental setup, when did you become aware of your conscious? But these guys were more trying to refine this, and the criticism that they refer to is that with this clock business, it was the person, there might have been too much going on. I mean, some psychologists and neuroscientists, not just philosophers, said Libet's way of sort of getting the person to notice where the second hand was, and then remembering it and then reporting it later, there might have been too much going on. So there might have been too much of a time lag in between the report, which is what one of your points was, and when the conscious intention actually happened. And given the crucial issue of timing here, this was a criticism that was directed at Libet's experiments. Okay, so that was one thing. Now we hop ahead 20 years later, and so these guys are using fMRI, functional magnetic imaging techniques, which have been around now, I think, about 10 or 12 years. I mean, they started out with athletes used to get MRI scans on their, I remember we first heard about this in the 80s and 90s, they would get them on their ligaments if they tore a ligament, and then slowly they've been worked up and refined to looking at brain patterns when people are performing various cognitive acts. So one thing that they did that was different is they wanted to, in some sense, well, use a new technology or a relatively new technology to see if what they call the decision-making process, not the sort of not the activation of the muscles or the potential to activate the muscles, but the actual sort of precognitive, or if you want to call it precognitive, decision-making process could be detected with this technology. But they also added a twist to the experiments, which was the person was sitting not facing a clock now, but facing a screen, kind of like a screen like this, the best I could understand, best I could tell. And on the screen, which was hooked up to a computer, which probably was also there were computers on Libet, but they were pretty bulky and primitive. So the computer was generating a kind of stream of numbers, like an 8 would come at you and a 7 would come at you. And so, and the person could sit and just sort of in the chair, and you'll notice both my hands are doing something because that's relevant too. And they were not only supposed to press a button, the decision was not only when to press the button, but which finger to use. Libet only used one hand. I don't know if it was the right or the left or if he discriminated between the two. So there were, in fact, the idea is there's two decisions. We can look at this. There's a decision to press and a decision to make a right or a left choice. Okay, so that, and then hopefully with this new setup where you're looking at these numbers, I guess kind of nice and, you know, coming up at you, the idea was you wouldn't be distracted, like, where was the second hand? There would be a more natural flow to your reporting of when, that was the hope. Okay, is everybody with me? So here we directly investigated which regions of the brain predetermined conscious intentions. So pretty loaded terminology already. Here we directly investigated which regions of the brain predetermined conscious intentions and the time at which they start shaping a motor decision. So this is kind of what Libet's looking at, right? The shaping of the motor decision. So what these guys see themselves as doing is taking even a step back in the process. Indeed, we found that two brain regions encoded with high accuracy whether the subject was about to choose the left or right response prior to the conscious decision. Okay? So, we'll go on from there. Now, Carrie Smith, she's writing in Nature itself, a little review article in Nature itself, taking aim at free will. So this is the article that Gary Gutting referred to in his New York Times column. The experiment helped to change John Dylan Haynes' outlook on life. This is her speaking. Still her speaking. The conscious decision to push the button was made about a second before the actual act. So they're talking about not the action potential, but what they're calling the cognitive decision to press the button and which button to press. She doesn't specify that here, but it's which arm to use. But the team discovered that a pattern of brain activity seemed to predict that decision by as many as 7 seconds. So, I don't know. That's a long time to think about it. I'm not sure which subject took 7 seconds to become aware. But anyway. That was an outlier, we'll call that. Long before the subjects were even aware of making a choice, it seems their brains had already decided. They argue that consciousness of a decision may be a mere biochemical afterthought with no influence whatsoever on a person's actions. According to this logic, they say free will is an illusion. That's still Carrie Smith, who's not a researcher, but is writing. I assume Nature hires competent people to write their review articles. And now Dylan Haynes, how can I call a will mine if I don't even know when it occurred and what it has decided to do? Okay, so. Now, one thing I'll point out here now is sometimes, I suppose it depends where one's sympathies are philosophically, but I think it's pretty clear here that these researchers, you know, we can try if we're a certain stripe of naturalist who's sympathetic to this stuff, try and say, oh, they don't really mean to be talking about free will. They don't really and try and sort of save them from their own public statements. But I think it's pretty evident that these researchers conceive their own activity as having a direct bearing on a metaphysical question. So I don't think we can sort of read the way Armstrong is generally sympathetic to Libet and saying, well, he says some things he doesn't really mean at times. I tend to be harder on the scientists. I think just because they're famous, they don't get to have a microphone stuck in their mouth and say whatever crap comes out. And we all have to, as philosophers, bow down and say, oh my God, we are philosophers. We should contradict the great science. I think these guys are just making some pretty bold claims. And so I'm going to look at some of these pretty bold. Perspectives. So I'm not even into my arguments yet, so I'm just sketching some things. One is media and science journalism. Why the sensation? And this is something that Carrie Smith writes. But critics still picked holes, pointing out that Haynes and his team could predict a left or right button press with only 60% accuracy at best. Okay, so one thing immediately is that given that you've got a 50% chance of getting this right, 60% might strike some people as not terribly good, right? I mean, that's still but I guess the response is it is statistically significant. So they're right enough of the time that we're going to call 60% statistically significant. But the reason I bring this up is if you read sort of the headlines on these things very often, you wouldn't guess that they had predicted with 60% accuracy. It's the media and science journalists, the science journalists. Nobody ever gets sold, their writing sold, if they say 60%. You've got to have crushingly, there is no free will, we're all doomed, or something like that, and then people were buying. So I think there's a definite question here as to how and why the media swallows some of these things. The way it does.
Sorry, Kevin. Do you have the absolute figures? Is it 600 times out of 1,000 times, or what is it?
That's available, but I don't know. I don't have it. Technical questions. So next, there are a lot of important issues and questions pertaining to the design and assumptions behind the use of fMRI techniques, one of them being averaging leading to functional localization, for example. The pictures are quite literally of no one's brain. So now, that's not quite true here, but very often when you see these shocking, that are supposed to shock us, pictures in journals, this is love. And they show some, you know, that's no one's brain. That is an averaging of a bunch of people's brains who are asked to think of your puppy, and then think of your puppy, and then think, and then they average them together. But those, and then what they do, the way fMRI works is the theory is that if you're thinking about something in a particular part of your brain, the increased mental activity will be correlated with increased neural activity, which will be correlated with increased blood activity. And since neurons need glucose, if they radiate glucose, if they attach a tritium or something radioactive, not lethally radioactive, to a glucose, that'll show up. So when they take the fMRI picture of someone's brain, it looks like nothing else is going on. You just have these little yellow spots, and for all you know, the person's dead except for these little yellow spots. The whole brain is working the whole time very actively, but on average, if there's more glucose going to the theory is more glucose going to the parts of the brain that have more neural activity going on, that'll show up. So you tone down the rest of the brain and you get this glow out from right. Now when they want you to show you the love place or the art place or the whatever when they're talking this way, what they do is they average these things out over several subjects. So then the pictures that you get is of no, it's like a Galtonian picture of the alcoholic, the criminal, the homosexual, the Jew, and whatever, any of those 19th century kind of pictures that you get. It's no person in particular. Now here, because they were trying to actually predict individual behavior, and I'll have to say something about that, they couldn't. And it's funny because of course the first thing I was looking for in the Nature neuroscience thing was where are the great pictures? Where are the colorful, scary pictures of telling me what I'm doing? And I couldn't find any online. I don't know if they'd been removed by the time I got there, or it may be that these localization techniques were not as critical to this particular set of experiments. Because when they talk about prediction, they don't mean here in real time. They weren't. I'm pretty sure. I'm not positive. This is not discussed also. But when they're saying we could predict whether the guy or the woman would press left or right, I don't think this was like they're standing there and she's there, she's going to do left. I think what happens is they recorded the events, and then when the timing, when she pressed and when she said, she became aware of the intention to press the button, and then they went back without them knowing what she did. So there has to be, they have to be sort of, some of the researchers have not, can't have access to the subjects, otherwise it's cheating. And then they go and look at the pictures after they develop and work them out with however they treat them. And then they said, they no doubt would say, I bet she chose left, I bet she chose right. And that's what I think the 60% is based, not in real time, he's going to do that. But I mean, it's as good, it's like saying, if I can predict when Mercury is going to go by the sun, or based on evidence, predict when it did go by, or describe when it did go by the sun. It's still basic principle, but it's not happening in real time. I don't think this has any big significance. But anyway, there are some technical questions here, and especially about the design of these experiments, and in particular the claims of localization, which I think are worth keeping in mind. Before I get to philosophy, I think Klaus brought up last time when we were talking about responsibility and the Armstrong paper, how I think he said in old Norwegian tradition is basically that we don't really care what your intention. I mean, I think this must have been before Protestantism, before the obsession with your goodwill and your good intentions. But the Vikings, I guess, if you screwed up, you screwed up, and you should have known better anyway. So you're just objectively responsible if you get yourself into a situation, then our understanding of action and responsibility is such that we don't really care what was going on in your head. You did it, right? So now, the reason I bring this up, I think, and he did introduce this way as a general ethnographic point, that I think different cultures often have different understandings of human action. And I think one thing that I'm sort of interested in is, I mean, if you said apparently the ancient Romans didn't believe in free will, they believed in just fate, everything was fated. I mean, I wonder if you could present results like this to some people and say, well, I don't care. So what? I mean, if this is a specifically Western Christian kind of obsession with free will, because, of course, the theological results of doing bad things are... I think there's an interesting question here, if everyone... And alternative conceptions of action, how they would line up with these things. Okay, now I'm getting to my point. Philosophy. I want to question what I think is the metaphysics of action that these experiments... that these experiments unwittingly presuppose. So I think there's a metaphysics of action here, of the structure of that, what an action is, that's just going unquestioned here. And that's what I want to focus on. Now, when I call qualifications, in the Carrie Smith Review article, she interviewed a number of fairly well-known philosophers of mind, some of whom follow these kinds of experimental techniques. And so when I say qualifications, I mean, I'm going to, in a minute, go after philosophers too. But before I do that, I have to qualify, because they're not quite as guilty. I think they are, but maybe not quite as some of these particular neuroscientists make some blunders, or some very tendentious assumptions, I should say. Some philosophers question the neuroscientists' results and interpretations. This is her, not me. Arguing that the researchers have not quite grasped the concept that they say they are debunking. Part of what's driving some of these conclusions is the thought that free will has to be spiritual or involve souls or something, says Al Malay, a philosopher at Florida State University in Tallahassee. If neuroscientists find unconscious neural activity that drives decision-making, the troublesome concept of mind as separate from body disappears, as does free will. This dualist conception of free will is an easy target for neuroscientists to knock down, says Glenn, another philosopher. Neatly dividing mind and brain makes it easier for neuroscientists to drive a wedge between them, he adds. So I think what the point is making here is we have this Cartesian... one of the things that strikes me often, I mean, this is whether it's Stephen Hawking or Steven Weinberg or Francis Crick, is the image of philosophers that comes out very often in these people, what they say, are kind of bumbling old country priests who are kind of, you know, believe in, oh, we all believe in souls and all dogs go to heaven. And they must have read, I don't know if they even took Exfil. I mean, it's so depressing, like the caricature of philosophy that comes out when some of these famous scientists get microphones in front of them is, I mean, there was a debate not long ago between Weinberg and Hawking. Hawking said, I'm a positivist, and Weinberg said, I'm a realist, and then they proceeded to occupy exactly the opposite positions on anyway. So here, what we have is that these neuroscientists, and often they think that if you're at all critical of what they're saying about the mind or action, oh, you must be a dualist. So you must believe that there are immaterial souls boinking against some part of the brain, like Descartes thought, that is driving this, and we're finding mental activity at the neural level with no reference to an immaterial gaseous soul hovering above, like a halo above your head, so you must be a religious fanatic or something like that. So here, I think this is the philosophers here making a fine point what is at issue here, I suppose if you're a dualist, a real hardcore old-fashioned dualist, some of these results are depressing. But if you're not a dualist, there's still lots of different things, directions you can take and things you can say about this. So what I'm saying is a qualification as to what I'm going to say about the philosophers now. So they've got, these guys that they interviewed have got something right. A little more about this. The trouble is, most current philosophers don't think about free will like that. Many are materialists, believing that everything has a physical basis, and decisions and act. This is the Carrie Smith referring to these philosophers, and decisions and actions come from brain activity. So scientists are weighing in on a notion that most philosophers consider to be irrelevant. Oh, that's a fair point, it seems to me. Philosophers who know about the science don't think this sort of study is good evidence for the absence of free will because the experiments are caricatures of decision-making. That's a point I'm going to elaborate on considerably. Even the seemingly simple decision of whether to have tea or coffee is more complex. Now, there's an important issue there, complex, than deciding whether to push a button with one hand or the other. Pressing a button or playing a game is far removed from making a cup of tea, running for president, or committing a crime. I think I'm interpolating a little bit here, but I think what's going this is referring to a Danish philosopher of mine, Adela Roskies, I think her name is. She's fairly well known in these circles. And I think the point that this is not quoting directly, but indirectly summarizing what a philosopher says in this paper. The reason I have, this is my italics in bold, the complex, is that I think what this philosopher is saying is that this action is such a simple one, right? So incredibly simple that what we find out about it can't be, or we should be suspicious of thinking that it could be decisive for more complex actions. More complex actions would be more stuff, sort of, in the action, right? Okay. So I think the word I'm focusing on here is more complex. You looking at the button pressing as a simple action and there being complex actions, so we should be, you know, careful about moving, generalizing from what we find about these simple actions to the more complex actions. What I find in most of these discussions, and I certainly found it in the Sennett Armstrong paper as well, is that most of these philosophers and neuroscientists still maintain what I would call a structurally Cartesian understanding of action. And here is something like what's going on. So, I mean, it's really the idea that an action has a beginning, that, you know, I start thinking about, this is the conception of action that phenomenologists have been criticizing for a long time now, the idea that what is action? I mean, Leibniz called everything that wasn't a theory was confused. All practice, according to Leibniz, was confused theory. And the idea being that real human action starts with this kind of Cartesian, I think I will go to Ramathusan now. I am now going to Ramathusan, right? This is our model for action. We have a pretty clear starting point and a pretty clear ending point. So there is a structure to human action, and this structure somehow resembles a mechanical structure with a beginning and an end, right? Structure of action is understood on direct or close analogy with structure of a mechanism. So I think there's an enormous assumption working in a lot of both philosophy of mind and the neuroscience going on. We'll look at that in a second. Before I get back to the whole issue of action, I'm not going to defend free will here. I think the entire debate, the traditional debate between free will and determinism is from my perspective, and this is a huge, I'm just bracketing this claim, is a bogus debate. Just looking at free will, the attempt to set up an idea, I mean, if you, I'll stop, think about it, what Descartes is basically, and Kant's solution, which was, of course, in typically Kantian fashion, kind of half brilliant and half crazy, was to simply remove the entire thing from anything you could see and put it in the noumenal realm, and that was that. Descartes' solution, if you think about it, has to be, and I think the traditional conception of free will, the reason I think it's incoherent, is somehow this, I mean, we all know this just from Exville, somehow this radically different kind of stuff has to not only interact with another kind of stuff, but it has to do so with, you know, absolutely no history or no involvement with anything before. It just kind of magically dips into reality, makes my arm go up, and then dips back out of reality. So, because if this thing that we call the will, and then we ask, is it free or not? If this thing is at all conditioned by anything, culture, heredity, environment, whatever, my God, we're not free. So the whole conception of freedom that one is being asked to defend when one defends free will is I think actually just kind of an incoherent picture to begin with. I don't think there's anything more I have to say about that, to quote Forrest Gump. And I think therefore the attempt to set up an idealized experimental situation for finding the action homunculus, whether we want to conceive of that as material or immaterial, is not only rife with what I think is bad Cartesian metaphysics. This would no doubt come as a shock to the researchers, who no doubt see themselves as on the front line against Descartes and philosophy in general. I think it precisely covers up what is more fundamental for action than cogitation. Okay? I think it's just missing the whole forcing the idea of action into this Cartesian picture, minus the soul, and then testing it under experimental conditions, is just missing the whole boat. Okay? So I'm not defending determinism, because I think that's got its own metaphysics that has to be defended. I would just reject that free will determinism thing as feeding off each other like an unhappy married couple after 50 years that can't leave each other alone. But I don't think we need. I think the question is not really worth asking. I'll come back to this in a second. So I'm getting into sort of roughly points that I want to make. I said I'd flag some of the arguments here. I'll leave out the free. Our meaningful actions, including those connected to the scientific enterprise, that's another important point I'll come back to, are not a function of somehow magically stepping outside of our physical environment just long enough to make a decision to have our bodies move one way or the other and then jumping back, you know, jumping in and out, jumping out. Instead, I think this freedom is connected to our active involvement in a world, and here I'm just gesturing at a lot of different thinkers, in a world of historical cultural factors, affordances, that's the psychologist J.J. Gibson's terminology, niches, solicitations, that's Dreyfus and Merleau-Ponty, whatever you want to call these things, right? Free, and this is the main point I'm trying to gesture at here, free is internal to our notion of human action qua meaningful. So what I'm saying is, the idea is, if we're talking about something, the question we should be asking, was it an action at all? If it was an action, look at the way we talk about it. If I say, Soren went down and bought a turkey at Raymond Tuzin yesterday, is it free or not? And then we get into this, is his will free? Is there this thing, this little round bubble somehow in his head called his will, like a ball, and then the will is part of that ball, and we ask, does it have this property or not? Oh, I would say, well, was he drunk or was he hallucinating? No. Did you talk to him? Yeah, he seemed perfectly rational. Did he pay his... this is all seem normal human activity. It seems like an action to me. Seems like he's responsible for buying the turkey. That's the end of the story. And then, but was he free or determined? I don't think anything can really be done with these questions. And I really... I mean, of course, I'm not. This is not a refutation. If someone wanted to put forward a fancy theory of freedom or determination, I would have to engage in the details there. But I still don't think anything comes of these discussions. So I think really the question that we ought to be asking is: are we talking about action at all? So I don't even. I'll drop free, meaningful action. Just action at all. Actions are involved in our environments. We don't have to. In fact, the key here is not to, you don't step outside your environment to have this causal thing. You have to be acting in an environment, which you can describe in many different ways: historical, cultural factors, the kind of things that normal human behavior is, right? And meaningful action does not necessarily require the cogitating I at all, whose supposed fundamental importance we have inherited from Descartes. Sometimes it does. I'm not saying Cartesian reflection is never important, but the idea that it is central is something I'd like to call into question. I think is a very tendentious assumption. But I skipped ahead. I just want to mention something about compatibilism by the way. I think, this is just a side note, I think compatibilism being the idea that free will and determinism are possibly compatible with each other, is I think gets something right, which is, I think that the idea that freedom is connected to a lack of outer compulsion, I think that's a fair point. The problem I have with compatibilism is the determinism side. I think it's managed to let go partly of the metaphysical free will question, but I think in its effort to show that a new conception, a different conception of free will is compatible with determinism, is hanging on to one of those poles that I think is itself problematic, namely metaphysical determinism. So what else do I want to start now? Okay. So part of the what I'm trying to gesture at here is also the action. I mean, this is all kind of embedded in this, is that whether something is an action or not is contextual. I don't think there's any giving a kind of determination outside of a particular context that we would have to describe determining whether something was an action. And that means, in a way, if freedom is sort of internal to action, that is to say, it's just built into the logic of how we describe actions, that they are, I don't see metaphysically free, I mean, the kind of freedom humans have is just built into what human action is, and that's determined by context, then we have to look at the context when we start asking whether something was, an action was free or not. And now, someone is going to be, one thing someone's going to be unhappy about, some people will be unhappy about here, and the part of the hope of using these kinds of experiments, often, and this came up in the Armstrong talk, which was, but what about legal responsibility? Because what, maybe these experiments can help us solve some of these legal dilemmas. Maybe so. I would argue that I think it's very fishy to let a very specific context like legal responsibility settle our overall picture of what is or is not a free human action. I think we can use that context for its own purposes, or we can, when we're involved in it, we do that. So I'm very skeptical of using such a context to decide what we generally overall think about action as. And what I'm saying here does leave open that, and this is why people who focus on the legal context are going to be very unhappy with this, is that there are going to be borderline cases where we don't know what to say. There are going to simply be very messy cases whether someone is acting or whether something is an action or a reflex or some other kind of movement but not an action, where if we rely on a kind of a pre-theoretical ordinary understanding of what an action is and context, sometimes we're going to come up against very messy contexts. Soren walking down to Ramatuzin to buy a turkey, the way I described the situation, was a pretty non-messy, but it could be really messed up if we throw in, and then he saw a guy get his head cut off across from the street. And, I mean, you know, you can start mixing things up, and, you know, sure, there are going to be, even if meaningful action continues to be our normal basis for deciding whether or not an action is free, there are going to be cases where it's difficult to decide whether an action is free or meaningful or mechanical. But I don't think this impugns the normal basis or its, and another point, our normal conception of action's requirement for the intelligibility of the scientific enterprise itself. Okay, I'll go on. I may go over a little bit, but... So, what I'd like to say about this, what these guys are doing, finally to get to my, I'm getting there. I would like to say that what can look to some like a kind of paradigmatic action discussed in the paper, consciously choosing to move either one's right or left hand, should rather be viewed as a degenerate case or limiting case of action. What do I mean by degenerate? Well, I thought of this when I was reading this paper back to my old days taking math and science classes. that I used to come up in math textbooks, this term of a degenerate, you know, a degenerate case. So in mathematics, a degenerate case is a limiting case in which a class of objects changes its nature so as to belong to another, usually simpler class. So a degenerate case, a point is a degenerate circle, namely one with radius zero. A circle is a degenerate case of an ellipse, namely one with eccentricity zero. A segment is a degenerate form of rectangle, has a length of side of length zero. I think you get the matter. In other words, of course, a point really is not a circle, and you could never build up your conception of a circle from your conception of a point. But if you want to look at a point, you know, changing your definition a little bit so as to fit it in under the class of circles, you can do it, but you shouldn't lose sight of the fact that points aren't circles, and circles aren't ellipses, and segments aren't rectangles, etc., etc., etc. Again, degenerate cases are borderline cases that shouldn't be considered to robustly fall under a certain concept. Okay? That they're not really, well, you know, a point really isn't a circle. Okay? A degenerate case thus has special features which depart from the properties that are generic in the wider class and which would be lost under an appropriate small perturbation. Okay? Now, because this was originally supposed to be a Wittgenstein thing, I was reading Wittgenstein's lectures, Cambridge, 1932, 1935, but I hadn't got this far, when I was reading this article, these articles and thinking about this stuff. But then, lo and behold, this is just gratuitous. This doesn't mean anything for the talk. I'm just throwing this in because it's supposed to be Wittgenstein-related. So, logicians have had the obsession that the life of a proposition is the copula is, but they know as well as we do that not all English sentences have a subject, a copula, and an adjective. They have said that every sentence can be reduced to such a sentence. The fact that it can be reduced is analogous to the following, that every closed curve is said to be a circle. So he's actually making a similar point. To the objection that a certain curve is not a circle, the reply is that it could be projected into a circle. To twist every closed curve can be projected into a circle, and to every closed curve is a circle, is exactly paralleled by every proposition can be transformed into one of the subject predicate form. But in neither case have I said anything about the method of projection, and until I do, I have said nothing. And then 37 pages later, he comes out and uses the actual expression, a tautology is a degenerate case of a proposition, probably referring back to the Tractatus theory of tautologies. I'm sure he's gesturing to Frege here, because Frege's idea was that if I give something like a command, what I do is I say Alois is going to the store, command sign. So everything, you know, because the criticism generated at a lot of philosophy of languages, well, Jesus, language is a lot more than statements. All you logicians are doing is dealing with statements, you know. And well, Frege's way of doing, yeah, but a question is really kind of a statement, and then in the question way. So Obama is president. No, sorry. Obama will win the election in the question way. So there's a kind of attempt to reduce all propositions, all uses of language to propositions. But then they're kind of a question kind of proposition. So I think that's one of the things that he's objecting to here. I'm guessing with Frege in mind, but it's not absolutely certain. Okay. So now, back to our neuroscientists. I think this is what I'm calling the bad Galilean assumption. And I think it's misled a lot of science, and I know it's been wildly successful for science in its own purview. But I think it's also been highly disastrous in a lot of others. I would be disagreeing, obviously, with our own chair, who 2 weeks ago said, this is how science works. You isolate things, you idealize them, and then you try to reintroduce them in the world and explain them. But I would add to that, and what's the guarantee that this always works? What is the guarantee that in the isolation of a phenomenon out of its context, you just don't lose your phenomenon? And there's a debate that could be had there. So highly idealized conditions, and I stress that can be imperfectly realized in a few cases. In other words, these guys didn't have a near 100% predictability. So we have a highly idealized situation, which I'm calling here a degenerate case of action, not even a robust case of action at all. Are in reality perfectly realized in all cases. So I can't make my plane, my inclined plane, perfectly frictionless. I can't make my balls, my breasts, whatever they were made of, you know, perfectly round. But I know that the closer I get, it seems to be approaching this kind of deterministic certainty. And so you end up getting, in the case of Galileo, this idea, aha, mathematics is the language of nature. Nature is this highly Platonistic view that nature is just written, not that mathematics is something that we use to describe natural phenomena. No, it seems that if we idealize for this, we get this view that mathematics is the very essence of what is going on. Mathematical laws are instantiated in nature. In this case, these guys aren't doing physics or mechanics, but I think the idea is that what we find here in our idealized little case might be just, if we build this up, that's why I emphasized the word complexity, is that maybe this is a simple case of how it always is. And all we have to do is get better and better and better and better, and we can add these things up, and we get a fuller explanation for more robust or complex actions. And what I'm claiming is that, or suggesting rather, is that our involvement in a social world of meaningful relations is required for the kind of self-reflection these researchers seem to assume is paradigmatic for action. That would be Cartesian kind of reflection, like, I'm going to move my thumb now. And I think it's very hard to make sense of those. What I'm suggesting is that I don't even think you can make sense of science, the activity of science, if you understand human action on the way these guys are understanding human action. I think the activity of science becomes, it falls apart. You can't give a description of what scientists do. Unless you want to go back to, I think there's some very tendentious rational reconstructions of science that were popular 100 years ago. I think it's very hard to make sense of these experimental subjects themselves participating in those experiments without first having that type of background and practice. This came up, I forget who it was 2 weeks ago, said, yeah, but the people had to sort of agree to all this. I'm gonna walk into the laboratory and sit down and da-da. All of these things were in the background. And I would argue that's the same case for the scientists themselves. So I'm done now. I didn't go too much over. The fMRI experiments, I want to say, look at a limiting, degenerate, idealized case of action. And so whatever these researchers may provisionally find, I think, has at best a limited validity for a degenerate form of action. And this is a slogan, not an argument. Natural science can only begin at the limit where genuine human action stops. I'm done.